Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. How are you? Lurking conservatives, how are you? Hey, folks, this is Morning Sedition. Savor it. Do you understand? Savor it. Roll it around in your mouth a little bit. Feel it. Taste it, because it's not going to be here forever. Dig? Beautiful. I hope you're having a good day. It is Wednesday, my friends. I will be at the Higher Grounds Comedy Club in Burlington, Vermont this Saturday night, November 19th, for two big shows presented by our affiliate, WVAA, 1390 AM. You can go to highergroundmusic.com for tickets. Haven't been to Burlington in a while. It's going to be chilly, but it's going to be nice. I like Burlington, Mark Riley. You ever been to Burlington, Vermont, my friend?
No. Did you just say dig?
Dig this, baby. That's right. That's right. It's Lord Berkeley Day. I don't know. Okay. The Naz.
I was beginning to wonder where we were.
Yeah, that's right, man. I just, you know, it's funny. We were talking about drugs yesterday. We had a long conversation about pharmaceutical drugs, about prescribing drugs, about pharmaceutical companies. I didn't talk much about street drugs, but it's interesting. There was an article today in the New York Times paper, you know, that paper they have here in New York, the New York Times paper.
The broadsheet.
Yeah, it's a popular paper here in the planet. Boy, I'm getting big. It's big idea day. But we were just talking about prescription drugs, and apparently there are young people today in their 20s stockpile prescription drugs either they have from illness or their friends or whatever. There's this whole little circuit. This has been going on since
I was... It's been going on for a while.
Yeah, this is not new news, but people are apparently self-prescribing antidepressants. They're self-prescribing painkillers. They call it self-prescribing. I call it just... party time, you know, for the recreational use, but that's back in the old
days. This used to go on in front of every methadone clinic in America back in the day.
Trading it up?
Of course.
People coming out with their vials?
Well, what they do is they save it.
Yeah.
Or they spit it back. Oh, anyway.
But these, yeah, I know. Let's not go too deep into our past, because I'd like to finish the show without you being arrested, Riley.
No, I'm innocent, man. I never did this. I only saw it.
All right, yeah, me too, man. I just saw it go into my mouth, and then things got different.
Yep.
But... What was interesting is that we were talking about it yesterday, and apparently people are self-prescribing themselves antidepressants, Ritalin, which I understand that's a buzz drug. Things like, obviously Xanax is out there, and it's a real issue because apparently it kind of goes under the radar a little bit. These guys, these kids aren't dealing; they're just friends. Or they're like, "You need a Vicodin? Yeah, I got one. I understand. You got a headache? You need an OxyContin? I happen to have one."
You know what's amazing about this, though, in reading it, reading that article that's in today's Times, it seems as though these kids are not, as a first priority, trying to get high. They're just trying to slightly alter their moods a little bit. If they're depressed about something. No, but see,
that's what they're calling it these days, Riley.
No, I'm not so sure about that, man. I'll tell you the truth. It sounds to me like they've reached a different paradigm with this stuff than back in the day. Back in the day, it was purely, what can I get high with? Now, it seems as though it's a different end game for these kids.
Well, you know what it is, Riley, is back in the day, it seems that getting high, and certainly some of the drugs that were going around, they just plastered you. And apparently, a lot of these kids, they want to maintain a little control, and maybe they've just grown to appreciate the persistence of just a mild buzz to give you that little edge in life, as opposed to like, dude, what did I do last night? Just tell me.
No, but you know what? Well, you know what struck me? There was a paragraph in there where a kid said he had some kind of problem, and he was trying to decide whether to switch from what he was getting to another prescription drug that he would get from somebody.
I knew a guy. A few years back, it's not that long ago, that used to carry around a bait box, a tackle box, you know, the compartmentalized screw box. And this guy had prescription drugs of all different kinds in each compartment of the box. And it'd be one of those things where it's like, how you feeling? I don't know, a little tired. He's like, I got a little something, you know, and he'd give it to you. Yeah. And these are all prescription meds. And I got to be honest with you, when I use drugs, there was a certain trust I had. The one thing you're dealing with when you take a prescription pill, whether it's a painkiller or not, is that you're dealing with a high-tech, well-crafted bit of pharmacy research.
As long as you know what it is and you do what you're supposed to do in terms of dosage. Otherwise, you have a nightmare waiting to happen.
Yeah. Well, Brendan just told me in my head that it was prescription pills that killed that wrestler a couple of days ago.
Oh, yeah, Eddie Guerrero.
Well, you got to be careful how you mix them. Listen to me now. This is a bad time for me to be talking about drugs, given that my life is going to be going through a dramatic change in a couple of weeks. You know, this is the time where I got to stay to the straight and narrow, man. You know, kind of like stay in the day, as they say in the secret club I go to. The Republicans easily, folks, shut down the Democrats' proposal for a timed withdrawal from Iraq in a 58-40 vote for their plan of significant transition to full Iraqi sovereignty, or what Bill the Stock Dropper Frist says is the difference is the Democrats, they want a cut-and-run exit strategy. What we are for is a successful strategy.
Oh, right. Really? Like the one we have now?
Right. The Democrats are actually trying to put something together that would facilitate the troops coming home. The Republicans want to frame their proposal as something that has no time limit or real basis in reality. So it's just sort of a big idea, like the war was. Now, what is the story on this, Riley? The Democrat proposal, which was a tiered and timed withdrawal over a period of time, just got pushed aside for something that is almost has no plan.
Well, what they've done the Republicans have been very clever at trying to make their proposal appear to be nuanced, appear to put the weight on the Iraqi,
uh-huh.
while at the same time distancing themselves from the Bush administration and its Iraq war disaster, because one-third of them are up for re-election next year.
So that means you get a gutted idea.
Yeah, and what they said essentially is, please, Mr. Bush, could you please tell us periodically, and by the way, this is in the original Iraq war resolution, how things are going over there.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I mean, that's essentially what they said. It is a non-binding proposal. All right. If the Bush can ignore it, he can implement it. He can do whatever he wants. He can wipe his butt with it. It doesn't matter at this point.
Right.
This is something that the Republicans are doing to save their own face.
But in that same way, it also protects them from saying anything that might hurt them in the future. It's one of these weird kind of middle of the road, you know, pieces of legislation that doesn't really say to do anything. It's just a political thing.
Well, yeah. And see, what they also did was include the compromise that we talked about yesterday in terms of the detainees and their access to the federal courts. Now they will be able to get access to one federal court.
So this is detainees held here in Guantanamo?
Anybody
suspected of terrorism can now, although they upheld the military tribunal thing, correct?
Yeah, they did, but you can argue your designation as an enemy combatant to one court, the D.C. Federal Court of Appeals.
And you can also, there's one other thing.
You can appeal the decision of a military tribunal to that same circuit court.
Okay, all right. So I guess is that good? Is that
bad? It's a middle of the road, white bread, solution to what is a devastating problem for this country, by the way. I mean, it's probably as good as they could have gotten given the circumstances and given, Jeff Bingaman from, where is he from? New Mexico, I believe. Your guy.
Yeah.
He tried to do something a little bit more definitive and it got shot down.
Well, look, you know, let's talk a little bit about Samuel Alito. We'll finish the conversation in a minute, but it was revealed last week from papers released from the Ronald Reagan Library when Samuel Alito applied for a job to be deputy assistant to Edwin Meese, that he made these very extreme statements about affirmative action, about abortion, that now he has to explain to senators. And this is the nomination for the Supreme Court, who is up for a vote soon. So we're gonna get into that a little bit about the senator's response.
Diane Feinstein.
Harvey Firestein, the senator. I love politics. I like working in government. I enjoy speaking on the floor to the people. It's very nice when I make a law. Diane Feinstein and Jeff Bingaman, and then the Republican response. It's very interesting what's going on, because this guy is actually selling himself quite well to Democrats, unfortunately. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
I gotta learn how to type, Riley.
Oh, you and me both.
19 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program.
I thought you knew how to type.
I do. I know how to hold my hands right. You know, I know how to put my fingers on it, but I still improvise a little bit. Like, what I'll do is I'll throw my finger into a general direction of a letter, like not onto the letter, so it's kind of a crapshoot. You know what I'm saying? I wish I knew how to type, because I watched Boy Genius John Crimmings, our researcher. The dude was like... And I'm like, oh my God, if I could do that, it would take me 10 minutes to
prepare for this show. Don't you want to just shoot somebody to say,
well, I mean, I don't have, how the hell do you do that, though? And Brendan's pretty quick on the keys. Passman was good before we lost him to Randy Rhodes' show.
They made us learn that stuff in high school.
You know what? Here's the funny. I took typing class so I could sleep. I took typing class in high school, and I couldn't stand it so much, and I didn't like the teacher, and it was just stupid. It was just an elective, and I wasn't thinking of my future at all because I didn't like school whatsoever. And I actually took a splint from my father's office. My father's a doctor, and I put it on my hand for the entire semester in typing class.
And now you wish you hadn't, don't you?
There's a lot of things I wish somebody would have made me do my homework. I'm telling you, do your homework, kids.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
If you're a parent, do whatever you can to make them do their homework. I used to come home. I don't even remember my parents even asking me how things were going in school. I'm not complaining here. I got problems.
Hey, I learned how to shoot things in school.
You did?
Yeah, man. I went to a military school.
I did.
You had to take 4 years of what's called MST, Military Strategy and Tactics.
You said that with a scary face, too. You're like, I learned how to shoot things.
And I'm like, I was an expert marksman.
Take it easy, man.
That's right. Shoot the head off a squirrel at 150 yards.
Oh, killing the little squirrels. All right, so look, we talked about Samuel Alito. We've talked about him quite a bit on the show. He is the new Supreme Court Justice nominee. Well, he made some statements when he was applying for a job in Ed Meese's office that were pretty disturbing. One of them was, quote, the Constitution does not protect abortion, end quote. When he worked for the Solicitor General, I believe Charles Freed, who was the Solicitor General under Reagan, Samuel Alito said, quote, I'm particularly proud of my contributions in recent cases in which the government argued that racial and ethnic quotas should be allowed and that the Constitution does not protect a right to abortion, end quote. He is now defending those statements to senators. He told Dianne Feinstein, not Senator Feinstein, Harvey Feinstein, I love the government. The Capitol's beautiful. Does that sound like him? It does a little bit, right? No? Huh? Nothing? A little? Huh? Nothing? Come on, Brendan, does it sound like him at all?
There needs to be a little more gay in it.
Oh. Hello.
There you go.
How are you? I enjoy being a senator. My mother would have loved it. All right. All right, so anyways, he told Dianne Feinstein that he was an advocate seeking a political job and that now he was a judge. He said he wasn't an advocate and that his job was to interpret law. And Feinstein bought it, Riley. At least she thought he was being straight with her. Absolutely truthful, as she put it.
Look, what he was doing, let's translate what he was saying. I was an advocate, blah, blah, blah. What he was saying was, I was kissing up because I was trying to get this gig, all right? And Feinstein, you're right, bought the idea that Alito was a kiss-up, that essentially he wanted this gig with Ed Meese so bad, he was willing to say anything to get the job.
It's so funny. I've got from Feinstein, I've got us both saying Feinstein. It's Feinstein.
Feinstein, that's right.
It's just like a little bug that gets in your head. So also with Jeff Bingaman, he was able to say to Jeff Bingaman, that was 20 years ago. This guy, this Alito, is charming these people. He's coming off as a reasonable guy, as a smart guy, as a guy that honors the law, as a guy that's got a track record. And it disturbs me because I really thought that there was some chance that we might get a fight here.
Well, I mean, since when does I was young and needed the money work as an excuse when you're talking about your positions on issues?
When you're talking about anything other than a history of hustling, you know.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what this has been. And he knew this stuff was going to come back. Now what they're doing is trying to hone a strategy for the confirmation hearings.
Well, look, we've got a caller on the line that maybe we should talk to because we were talking about the Senate vote. Now, in that vote, the Republicans won for their proposal about how to handle the Iraq war and what's going to happen. There was a very vague proposal. It didn't have a tiered withdrawal. It didn't have a timeline. It just had a sort of vague promise that, you know, we would try to get out of this. And five Democrats sided with the Republicans. Kent Conrad of North Dakota, Joe Lieberman, of course, of Connecticut, Bill Nelson of Florida, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, and Mark Pryor of Arkansas. We've got a guy here, Jim, he's in Connecticut. He wants to express a little, some feelings about his senator. Jim, how are you?
Hey, Jim.
I have to vent on Mr. Lieberman here. Guys.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, this is just the latest example. I'm sure you guys have followed him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Democratic Party here just has rolled over for him.
Mm-hmm.
He spouts his war rhetoric and that. Joe Biden dressed him down, I thought, quite well yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know about Joe. And I've heard some rumors. I don't know if you guys have heard them. Do you think Joe is going to switch and officially become a Republican?
Probably not, Jim. But, you got to ask yourself, why is Joe Lieberman such an extraordinarily popular figure in the state of Connecticut?
I thought he was talking about Joe Biden. I'm sorry. That's why I laughed. When you're talking about Lieberman.
No, that is a head-scratcher, Mark, here. Because, you know, this is a blue state. Mm-hmm. And he goes out of his way to back Bush. He's Sean Hannity's favorite Democrat and all of that.
And he defeated a Republican.
No one criticizes him here. The so-called progressives in this state basically have been muted, I guess, like Alan Colmes, but, you know.
But he's also, he beat a progressive Republican to get the gig in the first place. He beat Lowell Weicker.
That's right.
But
I've
always thought of Connecticut as a fairly sort of muted conservative place in some ways. Is it not?
In certain ways, it is, yeah.
Yeah, but not in the three major cities. Not in New Haven, not in Waterbury, not New Haven, not in Hartford, not in Bridgeport.
Right. Well, thanks.
The whole thing about Joe is that we have a couple of congressmen here, John Larson and Rosa DeLauro, who are against the war. Now,
from New Haven,
Rosa was on with Al Franken the other day. But you will never hear any of the Democratic people in this state criticize him. And I wish that somebody, I'll throw out a name, Phil Donahue, who's got the money, lives in Westport, why doesn't he run for the Senate?
That's a good question. He can just run on the platform of, Joe.
I'm not Joe.
Yeah, Joe Lieberman's, Sean Hannity's favorite Democrat.
You know, that's the thing about Joe, and we know Joe is already putting his feet in the water about Alito. I'm sure that he will back him.
Of course.
Yeah, that'd be my
guess.
He's
not going to be the only one either.
Well, but Joe, you know what Joe did with Clarence Thomas years ago?
What?
He was for Clarence Thomas until the very end, and then they didn't need his vote, and he voted against him.
Right, so that's called politics,
so
right?
That's Joe's way, but I'm just tired of him getting up there as a Connecticut resident, as someone who's fervently anti-war, that this chicken hawk, and again, Joe fits in the mold. He never served the country.
Right.
Well,
thanks for calling, Jim. I appreciate it.
Much appreciated.
Anytime you want to vent about Joe Lieberman, you're welcome to give us a buzz.
Our next guest, Joe Lieberman.
he is a contemptible guy because he's almost as contemptible as Bob Woodward, who we're going to talk about in just a second, who testified before federal investigator Patrick Fitzgerald, because these guys want to be close to the fire. They want to be Republicans. They want to operate like that. And the Democratic, I don't know if Woodward was ever a Democrat, but he was supposed to be a journalist. Now he's a shill. 27 past Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Okay, 34 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
I hope you're having a decent Wednesday morning. We're almost done with the week, kind of. I'm going to Burlington, Vermont tomorrow morning after the show, because on Saturday I'll be performing at the Higher Ground Comedy Club in Burlington, Vermont. That's November 19th for two shows presented by our affiliate, WVAA, 1390 AM. You can go to highergroundsmusic.com for tickets. Mishna Wolf will be opening for me up there. I'm looking forward to it. Haven't been to Vermont since college.
Hey, Maron.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Future Mark's on line one.
Cool. I love that guy. Put him on. Hey, buddy, what's up?
Please hold for Mr. Future Mark.
What? Oh.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, buddy, what's up?
Whoa, Mr. Future Mark. What was that? Your assistant or something?
No, of course not. That's just the one that handles my personal phone calls.
Wow.
My assistants have much more important things to do.
Okay, so where are you?
I'm just catching up on some work here at corporate headquarters.
Oh.
1 second, Mark. Hey, Stan, buy up 50,000 of RGG Preferred, all right? Just do it. Don't look at me like that. Do it.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
I work at some corporate headquarters.
Yes, Mark Guy. Mark Maron Global Enterprises.
Really?
Maron Co. If it rocks, it's Maron Co.
May I rub your neck, Mr. Maron?
Yeah, Lisa, that would be great. Oh, yeah. Right there. Oh, damn. You're a genius.
So wait, you're the CEO of a corporation? How did that happen?
Thanks, Lisa. You're a lifesaver. Here, go get yourself a new Marin Mobile. Get the one with the sunroof, baby. All right, what was that, Mark? Oh, okay. Well, you remember leaving Air America?
Not yet. I'm about to, but go on.
Okay, here's what happened. You went back to L.A. and got called to read for a TV sitcom pilot. Uh-huh. It turned out to be a cultural phenomenon, my friend, like Seinfeld, only much, much bigger.
Really?
You became an enormous star as Mark, the embittered former host of a liberal morning radio show who has 20 cats.
That sounds great.
It gets better, buddy. Not only did you single-handedly save the WB, your show absolutely swamped the sitcom competition, including Everybody Loves Franken and It's Janine.
Wow, really? That is awesome.
Yeah, everybody in America started saying, hey, buddy, what's up?
Huh.
I gotta say, it got a little old.
So wait, how did I get my own corporation?
Merchandising, my friend. You're the world's biggest manufacturer of Marc Maron coffee mugs, T-shirts, lingerie, condoms, and shotgun shells.
I make Marc Maron shotgun shells?
What are you gonna do? There's a lot of civil unrest. A buck is a buck, okay? Then there was your line of humor books. You know you're embittered in.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the cat products. Oh, my God, you made so much on the cat products.
Hmm.
Especially after they started cloning talking cats and people started using them as personal assistants.
Wow, it seems like everything I touch just turned to gold.
Pretty much, buddy. But you did make a misstep with the rap album.
Oh.
Mark Daddy Diesel. Really, buddy. What were you thinking?
Okay, dude, whatever. You got any advice for me in the future?
Yeah, you can save yourself a long legal battle if you copyright the phrases, hey, buddy, what's up? You must be on catnip. And here, pussy, pussy, pussy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and buy yourself a shotgun. Nobody's going to be safe.
Really?
Gotta go. I've got corporations to swallow. Later, man. I need tea now. Move it. What am I paying you for?
Okay, later. I guess it's going to be okay. I don't know if that's okay.
I don't know. You sounded like Sonny Corleone with your assistance there.
Maybe it's not okay, but it sounds like I land on my feet anyways. Hey, folks, federal investigator Patrick Fitzgerald spent a couple of hours interviewing who? Washington Post assistant managing editor Bob Woodward on Monday. Where did this come from? He testified that a senior administration official told him the name and position of CIA operative Valerie Plame a month before her identity was disclosed. He said the official told him in mid-June. That's a month before it was revealed in the press. He did not believe the information to be classified or sensitive. That's what he said. Now, this screws things up a little, Riley. The source allowed Woodward to testify and identify him. We don't know who he is. He's not allowed to speak of it publicly. The Post and Woodward refused to disclose the official's name. This would make Woodward's source, not Scooter Libby, the first to disclose the name of Plame to a reporter. This would shift the timeline that Fitzgerald put in place a few weeks ago. It doesn't mean that Libby wasn't trying to obstruct justice or he's off the hook or anything. Carl Rove is still under investigation, but what it means is that these reporters are going to be chess pieces.
Well, yeah, the reporters are going to be chess pieces. A, Libby's defense team is taking dead aim at several of the reporters who have been on the periphery of this thing.
Mm.
But with Bob Wood, first of all, it's important to note that Fitzgerald is still taking testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Most people thought he finished the day he indicted Libby. The fact is, he's still talking to people. And what's interesting here is that Fitzgerald is not threatening Bob Woodward with jail for refusing to divulge the name. Or actually, I guess he did divulge the name to the grand jury. Now the question is, will that grand jury leak? Probably not, because Fitzgerald hasn't even gotten a drip at this point out of that grand jury, much less a leak. So on his level, Woodward's secret is probably safe. But this does explain why Bob Woodward has for some time now disparaged Fitzgerald's investigation in the first place.
What happened to this guy? This guy was a beacon of integrity in journalism. I mean, we can't forget now that Bob Woodward is a Bush-Cheney shill. He's had access to the administration like no other reporter. Given what we know about this administration, that means he's a team player. Has to be. He is writing a third book on the Bush White House. He made statements, as Riley said, about a conversation. This was something else. He made statements with Walter Pincus, who was another guy that got the information. Another reporter got the information. Woodward under oath said that he had talked to Pincus about Plame. Pincus doesn't remember it, and he said he would have remembered it, given that he was researching it. So now what I want to know, could Bob Woodward been thrown into the mix specifically to shake things up, specifically to confuse people? I mean, like you said, you know, he said on Larry King, and he's been on NPR saying that this is no big deal. The Plame thing is going to pan out to be no big deal. Could he be a team player to the extent that he's compromised his journalistic integrity completely?
Well, I don't know, but he's got a problem with a reporter in his own newsroom, because his account of his conversation with Pincus and Pincus's account of that conversation differ greatly.
Right, exactly. So my theory is, and I don't think I'm the only one, I talked about it with Brendan, and he read about it somewhere else, is that it's going to get so confused with all these different reporters that both sides are going to be struggling to, you know, to just use these reporters as chess pieces to either obfuscate the reality of the leak or to make it dissipate or too confusing.
Well, yeah, and see, Woodward is leading the charge of this, well, this isn't so important school of the plane
Republican
leaking.
Frame.
Yeah, and see, what's interesting about that is they are all now jumping on the idea that the same newspaper, when they leaked the thing about the black sites, that was important, but leaking Plame's name was not important. It's amazing what they're trying to do here.
I can't believe it, man. I mean, you know, I've known this guy was a bore, and I've known he was, you know, obviously growing to be a shill. How many books can you write about George Bush? But this is one of those great heroes of journalism from the 70s that, you know, you respected. I did when I was a kid. I saw All the President's Men. I thought that this guy represented something, and he's just, he's nothing to me now. You understand? Fredo's nothing to me now.
While we're still in the Corleone mode.
Yeah. So look at this. There's a growing number of trucks that are powered in part by hydrogen, my friends. Big old diesel semi-trucks. The trucks are equipped with a unit that will produce hydrogen as they drive. Now, I guess that's different than just turboing a car. I don't know. I'm not a mechanic. But it's called hydrogen fuel injection, or HFI. It is a bolt-on part that goes on the outside of the engine. It injects small amounts of hydrogen into the engine air intake valve. It is made by a Canadian hydrogen energy company. The unit provides fuel efficiency and horsepower because hydrogen burns faster and hotter than diesel fuel. Obviously, I've written this down because I can't just speak off the top of my head about engines. Now, the HFI system produces hydrogen by using the electricity from the alternator to cause electrolysis of distilled water to produce the hydrogen. And it also burns cleaner than diesel. It reduces emissions a lot, like up to 14% with the nitrogen oxide emissions. This is a very practical technology, which is why you haven't heard of it or seen it on vehicles here.
Well, yeah, you won't see it on vehicles here. The fuel efficiency is only at about 10%. Doesn't make a whole lot of difference to someone that's driving a car. Makes a tremendous difference to long-distance truckers, all right?
But, you know, when you live in L.A. or a city, like my wife spends up to 2 hours a day in a damn car.
Yeah, yeah.
So it would make a difference. And also, given that L.A. just became the smog capital of the United States again, it would definitely make a difference in air quality, you know? So I just don't know why we don't see at least as a beginning, these technologies starting to surface in this country, you know, as a choice that we can have.
Well, I mean, you're talking about truckers that are saying that they're saving truck company owners $700 a month per truck on fuel. $700 a month. That's $8,400 a year.
I wonder why it is, Riley, though. You know, we have emission standards in this country. You got to get your car tested. I remember when the catalytic converter became a necessity in cars.
Oh, don't talk to me about catalytic converters.
Right.
No, because Californians are different. California has more stringent emission standards. I found this out when I bought a car that was from California. Mm. And the catalytic converter on the cars from California are different. It's amazing.
Well, I just don't understand that if this unit, this hydrogen unit, is safe, the hydrogen fuel injection unit, and it, even if it saves only 10% but makes the air a little cleaner, I just don't know why it's not available, because it must be affordable. I know they're making prototypes for fuel cell cars that are now, you know, priced at like millions of dollars to, you know, for the future of that type of energy. But I mean, if these things are available now, I just don't know why it's not available to us, because it would have to be regulated. We'd have to have it checked. I don't know how safe it is. Does it blow up? You know, when you say hydrogen, you think blowing up.
Yeah, and the thing is that the big car makers, in their quite finite wisdom, haven't figured out yet how to make money, how to profit from this stuff. Mm-hmm. Not on consumer vehicles.
Right. Well,
on trucks, yeah.
Maybe we can talk to some truckers. 866-303-2270. What do you know about this hydrogen fuel injection? Has it affected your driving? If you just want to say hi and you're out there in the world of darkness.
You just want to honk your truck?
Driving.
Honk the horn? Why not?
I mean, we used to talk to a lot of truckers. I don't remember talking to one recently, but I would like to know how this, the rise in gas prices are affecting them, affecting their politics, perhaps, and what they're doing to avoid going broke in that damn business. 866-303-2270. We're reaching out to truckers. It's 45 past. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition.
Right now?
Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
enchilada filled up with... All right, 49 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
We're talking about hydrogen power. We're talking about hydrogen fuel injection that some diesel truck drivers are using. I'm getting the impression primarily out of Canada. This is the technology developed by Canadian Hydrogen Energy. It's the HFI system, and what it does is it injects small amounts of hydrogen into the engine air intake. And the reason for that is it increases fuel efficiency and horsepower because the hydrogen burns faster and hotter than diesel, and it dramatically boosts combustion efficiency. And my question is, we got some truckers on the line here about either using it or what they would say from that, what it means to save 10% on your gas spendings as a trucker. And also, the big question is that if these are affordable and available, why can't we not have it on our cars? Or maybe that's going to happen, because it seems that some of the other ideas for alternate energy are just years away and cost way too much money. Let's talk to Bruce in California. How are you, Bruce?
Hey, Bruce.
Pretty good, Mark. Hi, Mark. How you doing?
All right. Pretty good. Where are you driving right now?
I'm driving a Peterbilt 98. I spend about a little over $1,000 a week on fuel. I just drive the state of California.
Wow.
LA and Bay Area.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
A 10% improvement would be a dramatic improvement for me. So I can see some benefits. I haven't heard it down here in the state.
Yeah, you would save about what? I guess you would save about
$400 a week,
$5,000 a year,
$400 a month. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, if you want to look into it, the company is Canadian Hydrogen Energy, and the system is the HFI system. You know, see what's up with that. I don't know if it's even available here. I guess we could do our own research.
It is available here because somebody uses it. They quote the president of the Great Plains Trucking Company in Salinas, Kansas.
Well, there you go. Ted, check it out, Bruce. See if it.
Well, I'll check it out. And I just wanted to tell you guys something else.
What?
Been driving up and down this state. I've got all the radio stations listed from Fresno to L.A. 1150 down in L.A. 96. 960 up in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
You guys are great. I'm running into more and more truckers that are listening to you. You're changing minds, and you're doing good for the country. Keep it up.
Oh, thanks Bruce.
Bruce.
That's great to hear, man. Be careful out there, man.
All right.
Well, this is one of those things that these guys don't even know about. You would think that there'd be a grapevine around this kind of thing, that if it really was as good as they say it is, that more of them would.
You know what happens? You get the guy, because it costs anywhere from $4,000 to $14,000 to put in. What happens is the fleet truckers are the ones that get it first. The guys that own the big trucking companies, they just retrofit their entire fleets with them.
Oh, I see. Michael in Texas, how are you, Michael? You driving today?
Hey, Michael.
Yes, sir.
Hey, are you on the road?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what do you know about this? What do you know about this hydrogen fuel injection?
I got some friends that use, and the only thing they're saying is that it's not holding together over like 300,000 or 400,000 miles.
The device itself is breaking apart?
Yeah, there's something about the injectors just don't hold up like it's supposed to, not like on a regular diesel.
Well, let me ask you, did they find it that when it was working, they were able to save some money, and that the technology is something that should be encouraged?
No, they weren't really pleased with it, because when it goes bad, it costs so much to repair it that it's not effective for their cost.
Oh, I get it. Well, that's
wow.
Well, that's
if they have a large number of them going bad, then yeah, it wouldn't make sense.
Now, in terms of, I don't know what your route is, but when you say 400,000 miles, something breaks down, for a trucker who is working every day, how long does it take to do that 400,000 miles?
If you're running a team truck like they were, it don't take very long. They cover about 300 to 320 a year.
Wow. So something, if you got to spend $15,000 on a piece of equipment every year, it's going to definitely diminish the savings. Thanks for your call, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, that's interesting. See, when it comes down to a technology, then all of a sudden you got to make it not only affordable, but it has to be durable and lasting if you're going to be using it to market to guys that are on the road all the time. That's something you forget. Because, you know, some of these guys that drive the cars, some of the town cars that that I take in the morning.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, those guys, the way they maintain those cars, they treat them like jewels, man. Because some of those cars are 10 years old. They got to keep them armor-alled. They got to keep everything on the inside looking like it's a new car so that people don't get in and go, oh, this is horrible.
Horrible, yeah. I got a friend that had a Lincoln Town car with like 450,000 miles on it or something. It's amazing how they can make those things run.
Yeah, and like the ones in Queens, the gypsy cabs are just a disaster.
Oh, that's different.
All right. Rich in Memphis. What's up, Rich?
Hey, Rich.
Rich. Rich.
Hello?
Hey, buddy. What's going on? You're in Memphis?
Oh, yeah, I'm in Memphis, yes.
And you're a mechanic? What do you know about this? What do you know about this?
I work at FedEx, you know, and we had one of our test trucks.
Yeah.
It's been on about five months.
Yeah.
Before we put on the truck, the fuel mileage is like 7.0. Then once we put on it, it came up like 7.2. It doesn't help a lot.
Oh, it doesn't do much, huh? So,
uh-huh.
And what's the difference between this this hydrogen fuel injection and turbo?
Well, the hydrogen, it uses distilled water, you know what I'm saying? The only difference, and it goes in the intake.
Yeah.
The turbo just like all diesel trucks have turbos.
Oh, okay.
Just normal.
That's an air intake system, right?
Right, right.
And it's a tank? Is it a tank that you put on the turbo? All right, well, thanks for your information there, Mitch. I appreciate it, Rich. All right, oh, here we go. How about Joe in Jersey? How are you, Joe?
What's up, Joe?
Morning, guys. Hey, interesting topic. BMW has a car for sale right now that can run on gasoline and hydrogen. And in California, they actually have hydrogen stations. But I wanted to point out a really interesting website called the Phoenix Project, and basically it's a map to switch the U.S. To a all-hydrogen economy in less than 10 years by positioning ships out in the ocean with windmills on them, because you need water and you need a source of energy to create hydrogen. And the amount of money we spent on Iraq, we could have easily created the whole infrastructure for a hydrogen economy in this country, and we could lead the rest of the world in hydrogen technology.
Wow!
But it's definitely the way to go. And
that's deep.
In our lifetime, probably we will see it, but it's going to take a while. But not with this administration, because they're so stuck on oil. But
well, we're going to run out of that soon. So this kind of stuff is necessary. Now I'm glad we got a break coming up, because I got to go check this out, Joe.
Yeah, the Phoenix Project. That's a really interesting site.
PhoenixProject.net. Thanks for the info, Joe.
All right, guys. Take care.
You too.
Take
care. Well, that's interesting, huh? I love big ideas like that. I like plans. I like all-encompassing plans, because we've talked to a few cats. What's that guy's name, the Peak Oil guy that we like? Kunstler. Howard Kunstler's book on peak oil. Man, you know, this stuff's going to run out eventually, and if we don't have a plan, we're going to have to return to agrarian society, which wouldn't necessarily be bad, but they're going to have to get rid of the suburbs and move back to the city, so someone better come up with something. I'm going to the PhoenixProject.net, 57 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
That's right. It's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That is my friend Mark Riley.
Yo.
We're doing the show. Savor it, my friends. Savor these days. Look, it's Wednesday. I hope you're having a good day. I will be leaving for Burlington, Vermont tomorrow after the show. I'm going to be doing a bit of the show from our affiliate up there, 1390 AM WVAA, on Friday. But more importantly, on Saturday night, if you live in the Burlington, Vermont area, I will be at Higher Ground Comedy Club in Burlington, Vermont. That's November 19th, Saturday night. You can go to highergroundmusic.com for tickets and information. You can always email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. And, of course, you know, most of you, you can podcast Morning Sedition and take it with you in your iPod or your MP3 player. Go to morningsedition.com to learn more. A little later in the show, we're going to have a guy on, Bruce Lawrence. Dad, this is some book, man.
It is.
It is some book. He edited a book called Messages to the World, The Statements of Osama Bin Laden. All right? I had to bring this book home to check it out. I was interested. I like reading just about anything. But I got to be honest with you, I was sitting there on the train reading my Bin Laden book. And I realized, hey, I don't know if this is such a great idea to read this on the train.
Excuse me, sir. Can I look inside your bag?
I was reading it there on the train. Also, Christina Borgeson is editor of Feet to the Fire, the media after 9/11. Top journalists speak out. She joins us in the studio. And the last time she was on, I'll tell you, we got a lot of emails, a lot of support. People really got into what she had to say. She's a very smart, intense woman, and she's put together this this great anthology of journalistic reaction and to the muting of journalism. So now let's get into the news a little bit. Before we do, let's finish this up. If you were listening before the break, we were talking about something called hydrogen fuel injection, the HFI system out of a company called Canadian Hydrogen Energy. Now, this is a system that goes on, that is a bolt-on system. It goes on to a diesel engine, and what it does is it uses the power from the alternator to electrolyze, to create the process of electrolysis of distilled water, creating hydrogen and injecting that into the air tank. And it makes it more fuel efficient, makes the horsepower better. But we've got a lot of calls from both sides. Apparently the technology, the machine itself, doesn't stand the test of time. There are some people who called and said it didn't create that much fuel economy or efficiency. And I just wanted to finish up here. But some guys were interested, and I think some people are going to research it. And from the conversation about hydrogen, we had Joe from New Jersey. He called us and said, go to phoenixproject.net and check out the plan for the future of alternate energy. And it has to do with hydrogen and creating hydrogen and ships with windmills on them.
Yeah, very interesting stuff.
All right. Well, John in Canada, you want to put a button on this for us? What's going on?
Hey, John.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, right, man. So do you have this system or you don't?
No, I don't. I actually just had a couple of opinions on it. I work on drilling rigs in remote areas up here in northern Alberta.
Uh-huh.
If they could perfect it or make some way to make it more, a lot cheaper and a little more resistant to wear and tear. Like up here, we've got to leave our vehicles running 24/7 all winter, right? And
yeah,
I think a 10% increase would be well worth the, just the cost of the environment alone.
Now, did you have price one of these units? I got it here that it says that the units are pretty small and they can cost anywhere from $4,000 to $14,000. And I'm assuming that your vehicles are pretty big, so you're going to be in the higher price bracket of that thing.
Probably, yeah. And, the other part is, too, you've got a vehicle down and you've got to get a mechanic up into the middle of the boonies to fix the thing. And, that's not going to wash at all.
Right, so...
Plus the volatility of hydrogen alone, you got a miniature H bomb sitting everywhere, especially if it's cruising down the highway at 110 kilometers an hour.
It's,
right?
Well, it's not doing nuclear fission, as it drives. You're not driving
over
there.
It's like, it's hydrogen, it's got to be pressurized or contained, I would imagine.
It doesn't seem like it. It seems like in this technology, what it does is it uses the alternator to create this process of electrolysis of small amounts of distilled water to create the stream of hydrogen. It doesn't seem to have a tank or a compressed air thing going.
Hey, there's one other point that I had was there's a diesel electric technology available. I know they use it on much larger earth moving stuff, a lot in mines and stuff like that, where they basically have a diesel motor to generate electricity, and then the drive is electric to the ground, off your hubs.
Yeah, I get it. Sort of like the Prius.
It's a lot more efficient, and the power is great, and it's actually really smooth and quiet. I've had the pleasure of riding in one, and the technology's there to.
Well, it sounds like
smaller vehicles as well, right? But
sure.
I guess they just don't because they can sell a lot more gas other ways.
That's right. All right, John. Thanks for calling us. Be careful out there.
Alberta. Northern Alberta, he's not just Alberta. Northern Alberta.
That dude is way up there.
Yeah, way up there.
Well,
I'm glad he's listening, though.
Yeah, no, it's nice. You forget that radio keeps people company in some of the darkest of places and some of the loneliest of places. I mean, when we first got on the air and those truckers used to call, it was just so wild to know that they were just screaming across the country in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And we're talking to them, man. I like
it. You used to get people from Wyoming and Idaho and Montana and all over the country.
Yeah.
And I mean, this guy is, he lives in a place that's so, they have to run their machines 24 hours a day, these
That's
rigs.
Cold up there, Riley.
Yo.
It is cold. So, look, I just want a reminder, the cost of mailing a letter is going to increase to 39 cents on January 8th. So if you need to prepare yourself for that, you know, buckle in, prepare yourself. Start getting those little stamps to even out the big stamps. Because, you know, I forget that some people stockpile stamps because either they got businesses or what, but some people have thousands of 37-cent stamps, and then they got to go and get the thousands of 2-cent stamps.
Well, you know what they did? They raised by a nickel the price of a postal money order. What's interesting about a postal money order is it's one of the few money orders in America, A, that's that cheap, and B, that you can buy over the counter. You know, bank money orders now, you got to be a depositor in order to get one.
Well, you know, you can do what I do. Just use the meter at work. You know, if you got, I mean, come on. If you work someplace and you know the mailroom guy, you just go, dude, you just do me a favor with this.
Yeah,
it's going to England.
Up,
is that all right? But just for the company's sake, it's all the Air America business.
It's
Air America business that I'm doing. You know, sending those autographed pictures
on,
out to London.
I was trying to give you the comedian frame.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You just goofed.
It was a joke that didn't work.
It was a joke resume that I was sending out.
I just had to get those demos out to a couple of radio stations. All right, look, the postcard stamp is going to go up a cent. But, you know, the sad thing is when you get those 1 or 2 cent stamps, you still got to lick those stamps. So, you know, get ready for that. I just wanted to let you know a month or so ahead of time so you have time to prepare yourself for the lickage.
Uh-oh.
All right, here we go. Let's talk a little bit about this Senate vote. The Republicans shut down the Democrats' proposal for a nice, you know, well-orchestrated, time-tiered withdrawal from Iraq. They shut them down in a 58 to 40 vote for their plan, or what they call a, quote, significant transition to full Iraqi sovereignty, or in other words, what Bill the Stock Dropper Frist said. He called it the right. What did he say? We are the Democrats want a cut and run exit strategy. What we want is a successful strategy. You know, honestly, what the Democrats had in mind was a timed and tiered withdrawal. So we add a structure. What the Republicans had voted for is this vague idea. It's an idea that has no parameters.
Well, it has no parameters. And it is generally seen, I think, as a prod to the Iraqis to try and get them to take over more of the operation of their government. Now, consider for a moment the fact that we invaded their country. So far, about 30,000 of their civilians are being killed. And what the Republicans are saying is, you know, suck it up and let's go to work here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is it? The average Iraqi gets, what, 4 hours a day worth of electricity?
That's what John Warner said. He said, come on, get off your, you know, get off your cans. Like, as if they're just sitting there going, oh, man, I'm so
waiting
glad.
Waiting to get bombed.
I'm so glad these guys are here because now I don't have to do nothing. I mean, it is crazy. It is insane what is going on in this country, in Iraq. And the idea that these lawmakers are just saying, well, they just got to pull themselves up from their bootstraps. But let's not, and we didn't miss the point as to what this was about. What the Republicans are doing here is they've created a completely meaningless proposal, primarily to undercut the Democrats and primarily to distance themselves from Bush. So they're just watching out for their own butts here. That's all that's really going on in the big game plan. Isn't that right, Riley?
That's absolutely right. When they go back to their constituents over the holiday weekend, the holiday period, I should say. Now, it's not way more in the weekend, which they'll be doing soon, they'll be able to jump up and say to their constituents, we stood firm on wanting to get a time, you know, timetable. We rejected the timetable on Iraq, but we've got the president's feet to the fire, and we're going to find a way, and we got the Iraqis' feet to the fire, like, you know, when we're not bombing them, we're burning them.
Yeah.
And you know, it is all political pantomime.
We stood firm on a vague idea.
Yep. Yeah.
And one of the dumbest ideas I've heard, for as much as I care about Time Magazine's Person of the Year, which isn't much, was NBC's Brian Williams suggesting Hurricane Katrina for the silly honor. Well, not Katrina exactly, but Mother Nature.
Mother Nature.
Yeah, this would include earthquakes and the tsunami, and Williams thought that it would it could tie in Iraq and petroleum and presidential politics. It's kind of like making Time's Person of the Year Time itself.
Father Time.
Because that'll get you everything. I mean, then it's just like everything, you know. You can just put it all in there, like, every second, you know. Williams was just one of the 6-member panel that included Anderson Cooper, Matthew Cooper, Democratic political consultant Donna Brazil, Grover Norquist, the evil bastard, and WorldCom whistleblower.
Why does Grover Norquist get to choose who Time's Person of the Year is? Can somebody explain that to me?
He must have dirt on everybody, that guy. You know, this revisionist, conservative activist I'm not. All right,
and you know
stop.
What his idea was,
yeah,
don't you?
I do. I do.
One that is personally insulting to me, but go ahead.
You know, you tell it.
All right, I'll tell it. He wants to put Condoleezza Rice and Rosa Parks next to each other, like Condoleezza Rice wouldn't need a stepladder to tie Rosa Parks' shoes.
Well, this is the same mentality that wanted to put Reagan on the dime just to erase FDR's legacy on currency. I mean, it's amazing how people are willing to abuse the dead. Other suggestions were air, the sun, asphalt, the iPod.
Air, sun, asphalt, and the iPod, all of which we desperately need in this country.
Well, you can bring so much in. You know, with the iPod, you can bring in music and recorded poetry and speeches of politicians, so it covers everything. And asphalt, you know, everybody has to drive on roads, so you can tie it all together with that and the sun. Who doesn't need the sun?
Do you have any of them Sam Brownback tapes?
Yeah, I'll get one of those. We got, no, actually, there were some of the suggestions were Bono, Zarqawi, as you said, Rosa Parks. But I don't know if Norquist said that it could go without
Condoleezza Rice.
So Rice was probably a separate one. But this is a ridiculous honor. But if you've got some funny suggestions as to who you might think it should be, 866-303-2270. Who's your Time Magazine's Person of the Year? It's 18 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270.
Call me, doggy.
Twenty two past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yep.
That is one of the great guitar licks. I gotta be honest with you, if I can go a little F up a little classic rock FM on you. That is F Fogerty riff. I don't even know if he's playing it, but man, when I was a little kid I had this album. Cosmos Factory, I think, was the album. I had a tape of it that my parents had left in a box of tapes when I was like 10 years old. And that riff just permeated, just burned itself into my brain. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. You ready, Mark Riley?
I'm ready.
All right. President Bush, reeling from criticism, has become increasingly reclusive and now rarely speaks to his father, according to a report in Insight magazine. Bush maintains daily contact with only four people. First Lady Laura Bush, his mother, Barbara Bush, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and Undersecretary of State Karen Hughes. Your guess is as good as mine to which one of them supplies the blow. That's Coke, not the other one. Bush is so depressed, last night he hired Jeff Gannon to come over and just hug him. Yes. Refusing to talk to anyone is a radical departure for President Bush. Prior to this, he just wouldn't listen to anyone. Hello. Yeah. White House staffers say that behind closed doors inside the Oval Office, they can hear the sound of clinking shot glasses and slurred demands for the nuclear football. The nuclear football. Hurricane Katrina is being proposed for this year's Time Magazine Person of the Year. Meanwhile, Grover Norquist has proposed a shared cover of Rosa Parks and Condoleezza Rice. NBC anchor Brian Williams chose Hurricane Katrina, while CNN anchor Anderson Cooper looked confused and chose his hair. His hair, people. Right. Sticking with the shared cover motif, Williams suggested Hurricane Katrina or Mother Nature as the front cover and Michael Brown on the back cover, totally oblivious to the front cover. Totally oblivious because he was in... Hundreds of truckers are already using a gas-saving, pollution-cutting hydrogen fuel system made by a Canadian company. Although use of hydrogen portends well for the future, experts point out that the vast majority of truckers are still powered by methamphetamine. Truckers say the best thing about the use of hydrogen as a fuel is that they don't have to change the Ask Gas or Grass bumper sticker that they've had on there for years. All right. Oh, you're going to do phrase of the day? We wait till the last one, though. Let's wait till the last one. Let's take some calls about the Times Person of the Year. As you know, as I just mentioned, there's a lot of speculation on who it can be, and I decided, why not open up the phone lines?
We got some interesting people out here, too.
Let's hit this quick. Cindy, okay, wait. Who's calling? Kent in L.A., how are you?
What's up, Kent?
Hey, I'm great. How are you guys?
Good. Who's your Person of the Year?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this for a while, actually, before you brought it up, and I just think that this past year, Cindy Sheehan has been the person.
That's a good one, man. I think that's a good one.
I would agree.
Thanks, Kent. All right, here we go. Tom in New Jersey, who do you think?
The person that George Bush Sr. called a true American hero, Joe Wilson.
That's a good one, too. I like that guy.
Split covers, you know, Rosa Parks, Condoleezza Rice, Cindy Sheehan, and Joe Wilson. Why not?
That's an interesting pairing.
Yeah.
Kathy in Ohio, who do you think?
Sammy DeStemso. He embodies the meanness and cruelty of the right with his attitude.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, my God, he's a stem cell. You got abortion, you got scientific research. Everything.
It's all there.
It is all there.
My serious candidate would be Michael Schiavo.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks for the call. That's good. That's good. Patrick in West Palm Beach.
What's up, Patrick?
Hello. What do you got?
Yes,
who's your guy?
I love you guys.
Thanks, man.
Well, I think it's got to hands down be Michael Brown.
Hands down, it's Michael Brown.
Yeah. Hands down. That's
Michael,
how he was.
We should put that right on the cover. Hands down, Michael Brown. Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick.
You know, they do that sometimes. They put the evil, weird guys that have impact. They put Hitler on it years ago, I believe.
Yeah, I believe they did.
Kathy in Jersey, who do you think?
Hey, Kathy's not up. I think it's Wes in Iowa.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wes in Iowa. How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good. Who do you think?
For a serious pick, I got to go with Fitzpatrick because of,
Fitzgerald.
Yeah. Yeah, and for a not serious pick, how about Karl Rove? You know, he's been, has anyone else had more influence on our politics in the last 5 years?
Why do I think he was it? He was never it. That's unbelievable. I hope he's missed his opportunity. That's true. Thanks, Wes.
Thanks.
Yeah, but Fitzgerald would be good. I think he's going to have his day.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
And I see a couple of people, someone, Kathy in Jersey up on the thing said Barack Obama. I think he'll have his day as well. So that's interesting. We've got a good bunch of calls there. We're going to come back and we're going to talk to Bruce Lawrence. His book is an edited big edition of the statements of Osama bin Laden. I was afraid to read it on the train. 27 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm sitting here holding a book that our guest wrote. Our next guest is a professor. He didn't write it. He edited it. The guy who wrote it is Osama bin Laden. Our guest is a professor of religion at Duke University. He's also the editor of this book, Messages to the World, The Statements of Osama bin Laden, which releases this week. Bruce Lawrence, welcome to Morning Sedition.
Thanks, Mark.
Morning.
We're just talking about how I was on the subway with this yesterday, and I felt uncomfortable, but then I had that moment where I'm like, well, I'm going to Queens. You know, I mean, there's going to be some people that are going to be like, yes. Now, look. Why this book? You know, why now? This is really just transcripts of a lot of missives in all different media from Osama bin Laden. What brought you to this?
Well, the reason it came out now is because the war on terror hasn't gone as expected, or at least as some folks in D.C. expected it to go. And so instead of bin Laden being a case history who's no longer important, he continues to be in the minds of a lot of folks. Jordan last week and God knows where tomorrow, but this guy is not dead. He may be actually dead, but his message isn't. So it's time to get the message out. It's available in Arabic everywhere in the world, but this is the first time it's come together in English.
Okay, so this was, but you are, as a professor of religion, as somebody who is a student, I'm assuming, of the world's religion, there must have been something that fascinated you about bin Laden other than just the political ramifications of who he is.
Oh, yeah. Back in 2001, I got a French editor to zip me a book, and then I had it translated in English. I called in the name of Osama bin Laden. It's fascinating how the guy uses the past, uses history, uses scripture for his own ends. And then when these folks, Verso, got in touch with me in the spring and said, hey, you know, we think it's time to have the real bin Laden, not the secondhand or the also-ran bin Laden. We're going to trace his transcripts. We're going to get the Arabic. We're going to do fresh translations. Would you make sense of it? I said, I think it's probably going to be pretty dull reading, but I'll give it a try. I was electrified. The guy's a great rhetorician. He knows poetry. He knows how to hit the stops. He picks his audience and his spots, and he does the job.
Bruce Lawrence, you maintain that Osama bin Laden has been mistranslated in terms of what his writings or videotapes have said to the American people. How badly, and give us some examples of complete mistranslations of what he was trying to say.
Well, September 11th, I mean, I can't think of a bigger mistranslation. I mean, why did the guy do it? You know, if you read all of the letters, I mean, you know, it's 20 letters. It goes over 10 years from 1994 to 2004. he first starts out, I mean, the people he really dislikes is not the U.S., it's the Saudis. And it's really clear that he's got a tremendous grudge against them because his father made his fortune with him, and then he didn't have a sequel, which is not a fortune, but the opportunity to be a big political player, which is really what he wanted to do in his homeland. He got exiled. He got mad. He did a lot of nasty things, but he never takes credit for 9/11 until about 2003. And then he says, hey, you hurt my people, you killed me, I'm going to kill yours.
Now, does that imply then that he was just greedy for power? Is that why he came to hate the Saudis? I mean, it would seem as though, you know, you come from a filthy rich family who made their fortune inside this kingdom, you would be down with the program, wouldn't you?
Right, you think he'd be down with the program, except his program is not his. It's his with a capital H, meaning he thinks he's doing God's will.
Okay.
And he doesn't see the Saudis as living up to God's will, which means Saudi for Muslims only, not just any kind of Muslims, but Muslims who don't tolerate the apostates, that is, people who don't acknowledge Islam, even though they claim they're Muslims, and the infidels, the people who never wanted to be Muslims. So he says, look, you got to have a pure state.
But then he never
shows you how to get there.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Like, the bottom line is most of the hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi, and
right.
He was making a point with that as well, because there's such a schism in Saudi culture between, you know, jihadists and religious extremists that come from the Muslim Brotherhood on through the Wahhabis and the royal family itself. But let's talk about how this administration frames bin Laden in relation to what you see in his writings, because a lot of people are fascinated with Hitler. Anyone is fascinated with anybody who can have this type of impact on millions of people to bend their will into theirs. Do you see this as the writings of an aware totalitarian thinker who has a totalitarian agenda for the planet?
You start out saying something really interesting. His appeal is not totalitarian, but it's absolutist in the sense that, yeah, you compare him to Hitler, but the difference is he didn't have a state. He didn't have an army. What he's got is he's got a ragtag network of terrorists. And I think actually the key thing is he jumps over the heads of the rulers. Unlike Hitler, who just invaded countries and took down people inside and outside his own Nazi regime who didn't agree with him, he has to appeal over the heads of rulers to young people, young men. He likes the testosterone age, 18 to 30.
Sure.
That's his pick hit. And he says to these people, you're never going to make it with the real guys. Make it with me because I'm with the big guy.
So it's a nation of the mind, which in some respects is more threatening, given the appeal and the poverty in the world and the anger towards the West, that, you know, he in some respects in the long term is more threatening than Hitler.
Yeah, it's a poverty.
Ideologically.
It's a poverty of imagination that he appeals to. And I say it again and again in the book. Where are we going to find an alternative? This guy has a black and white world. We all know the world is gray. How do you make gray attractive?
Why do you think that is it his communication skills that makes him so popular in the Arab world? Is he, in fact, as popular as Americans believe, at least in terms of opinion polls, in the Arab world?
Probably more popular. Yeah. And listen, I read the guy in Arabic. I listen to the guy in Arabic, and I say, whoa, I know he's wrong, but he is seductive. He's got one hell of a line. He knows how to preach, quoting scripture. He can outdo Billy Graham in that line. He has poetry up the wazoo. He can quote verses, and he can make up his own. Okay. One of the big things there towards the end is a sermon he gives. I didn't think he gave sermons. I read it, and I said, this sounds different. It sounds like he's preaching. He was preaching. It's a sermon he gave on satellite TV. Hey, how many millions of people watch satellite TV, Al Jazeera? 53 million.
So this is it's beyond cult leader status. It's beyond it's a momentum. That's very frightening. And I think that the decision to publish this is very interesting, because I think that if there is a myth around bin Laden, it certainly is one here, and it's the myth of pure evil, and it's something that I think a lot of Americans don't even know what this guy is saying and don't even realize that there's literally hundreds of pages of missives from bin Laden. Now, what I want to know, I guess, is do you think that this book is going to be read by American Muslims in terms of I don't, you know, a book like this, whatever your intentions were, there's nothing wrong with information. This is a free society, and I'm glad that Mein Kampf is available for people to read. But do you sense that this book will be read by exactly those people that bin Laden wants to recruit here?
Well, no. I don't think the people he wants to recruit here are going to read it. I think the people who are going to be attuned to his message have already heard it, not in this, but in audio tapes. One of the things I mention again and again is, listen, we're just doing translation of what are audio tapes. Audio tapes circulate around the world outside in Arabic. And those, the American Muslims whom I've heard from who've read this book said, thank God you showed this guy has his bad spots. The bad spots are he misquotes scripture. Of course, I said he's got a beautiful voice. He's got a hell of a mind. He knows a lot about the past, but he also misquotes, misdirects, shapes things according to his own outlook, and it's not the outlook of most Muslims.
That sounds familiar. The religious right does that here. I just made a note to self, Brendan. Brendan, note to self, Osama bin Laden infomercial for a series of tapes.
Yeah, okay.
Bruce Lawrence, I get a sense that one of the things that Osama bin Laden has a problem with in terms of the West is the notion that he seems to believe that people think that the Arab world is backwards somehow, less than civilized. It's certainly in terms of the behavior that you've seen with beheadings and things like that. It's easy to promote the idea that the people that are doing this are you know, barbarians or something. How does his writing speak to that issue?
Yeah. What he does is a great question. And what he does, like all you guys, questions are great. But what he does is instead of talking about barbarian things like beheadings and chop-chop squares, as called in downtown Riyadh, what he talks about are the Iraqi civilians who've been killed, not by Arabs, but by Americans. So he says, hey, my innocents are anybody who's Muslim who's been killed by foreigners. So he takes credit for the Palestinian deaths that Israel has inflicted. He takes credit for the Iraqi deaths the Americans inflicted. He didn't go toe-to-toe with Tony Blair and say, you killed my guys down in Basra. I'm going to get you. It's reciprocity. You take mine out, I'm going to take yours out. I haven't got your big army. I haven't got your big budget. I'm not a hyperpower. But I do have people on the ground. I do have my own source of income, and I'm going to fight you to the end.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes him sort of a religious figure, is that this sense that he speaks for all of the downtrodden in the Arab world, for all of the victims of Western aggression anywhere, or Israeli aggression. Do you think...
It's anti-imperialism wrapped in the Quran.
Oh, okay, there you go. Well, now this is a book that is filled with anti-American sentiment, it's filled with anti-Saudiist sentiment, it's filled with anti-Jewish, anti-Israel sentiment. Now, do you think that a message like that, obviously... If this guy does turn out to be dead, he could have died in the earthquakes. He could have been, right. He could have been dead for 2 years.
Not 2 years, because the last one of these things is December. It's December 2004. He could have been dead for 10 months, but not 2 years.
Months. There you go, 10 months, unless they did some really good film work. Now, but let's. But obviously, it doesn't matter, does it?
No, the messenger could die, but the message lingers. Mm-hmm. No, it lingers. But it grows every day in Iraq. And the sad thing about it, I'm not going to say that there weren't some justifications. There certainly weren't weapons of mass destruction. But there may be some justifications for an American presence in Iraq. But the longer we persist, the more there ammunition there is. In fact, someone said, reading my book, the best resource for OBL is George Bush's foreign policy.
That's absolutely true. And we're seeing evidence of that.
How do you assess how bin Laden looks at the people that he's communicating with? Assuming that he's not figuring that his primary audience is American, what do you think he believes about the people that the primary people that he's talking to here?
Primary people he's talking to are young men. Young men, Arabic-speaking men, not necessarily all from the Arab world, but they're at least familiar enough with Arabic to respond to his message. Many of them are Pakistani, Afghani, so they're not Arabs. But what his notion is, we have to fight because we are being attacked and we are being occupied. And so his message to them is, I don't know how it's going to come out, but I do know that you can't get to where you should be unless you take up arms, unless you fight as I fought, give up your other pleasures and pursuits in life, and take on jihad. That's his message.
But does he have a sense at a point that of what they're going through, the fact that many of them are not employed, many of them see no hope for the future? How does he speak to that? How does he get them to follow him based on what he's saying versus based on what anybody else is saying?
Mark, that to me is the great enigma wrapped in a puzzle paraded as a paradox of bin Laden. Is it's a great message if you listen to it and think of it rhetorically, but if you take it to the end, there's only one end. You have to hope you're going to go to heaven because you're certainly going to die. There's no place on earth for you to get a better world after following bin Laden.
Well, the book is Messages to the World, the Statements of Osama bin Laden. It is edited and introduced by Bruce Lawrence, who has been our guest. Thank you. Very interesting. Looking forward to reading it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark and Mark.
You bet.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you were here. So, look, we got the War on Brains coming up, and as you know, Jim Merle is having a war against his own brain, so this should be interesting. 46 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. And as you know, every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Deadline, Washington, D.C., a place where something important happened a long time ago, and punchline.
hey, what's going on here? Where's Morse?
Hi, everybody. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Dee doodly dum dee doo.
Whoa, Wait a minute. Where's Mort?
I don't know. Dead?
Hey, Mark, it's me, Brendan. We got a call on line one. It's Mort.
Hey, Mort, is that you?
Yeah, Mark, it's me, Mort Milfington. As you know, my last name is an hilarious pun referring to sexy elderly women.
Sammy, you said Mort was dead.
He was dead when I left him.
I am dead, Mark. As we speak, I'm in the afterlife, speed dating with Clara Peller.
Sammy, how could you do such a thing? You're a stem cell. You're sacred life.
No, you're not going to pin this one on me, Mark. I mean, you know, we've had our differences in the past, but I've always respected you. Over the last few months, well, I guess you've become my only friend. No, you've become the big brother I never had. No, you became the father I never had.
Well, gosh.
You nizzling nard gargler?
I mean, I've never had anyone say something so touching to... Hey, wait a minute. Did you just call me a nizzling nard gargler?
Call him as I see him, you yammering anta.
You're disgusting.
And you're welcome.
Mark, it's me, Brennan, again.
Yeah.
We've got your wife, Mishna, on line two.
Oh, Mishna, great. Put her on.
Mark, it's your wife, Mishna. When are you coming home, sugar cakes?
Mishna, you sound so strange.
My arms await you, Marky Moo.
Soon, darling. Soon.
Mark, it's me, Mort.
Yeah.
Did you kill me? Oh, and can you get Claire an 8x10 of Jon Stewart?
God, what a terrible thing to ask. And no, I didn't kill you.
Mark, we got Sam Waterston on line five.
Hello, Mark. This is Sam Waterston.
Sam Waterston?
Confess to one count of negligent homicide and I'll file a writ of mandamus so fast it'll make your head spin.
Writ of mandamus?
This has been Sam Waterston for the History Channel's Time Lab 2000.
Stop it. Wait, I didn't kill anyone. And I don't understand that obscure Time Lab 2000 reference.
Mark. Huh? Mark, wake up.
What?
It's me, Brendan.
Huh?
You were having a poorly written dream.
What? Huh?
Dude,
what?
You gotta stop sleeping in the studio, man. It's over.
It's over?
Riley's working for Cedric the Entertainer, and Jim's living at his dad's, but he's still freelancing for Tavis Smiley.
Oh, God, no! And what about Pashman?
Who?
You know, all I ever wanted in life was to be validated by a group of complete strangers and receive unconditional love from a faceless audience. But over the last 2 years, I've learned there's even something more important than the superficial high fame can give you. And that's a contract.
Yeah, now you're talking. Give me that bottle of laudanum, will you?
Yeah, Mark. And we don't ever want to see you in here again. Understand, you plute-headed sauce monkey?
Plute-headed what?
Hey, Mark.
Yeah?
There's somebody special here, and I think she wants to take you home.
Mishna!
Yes, dude. It's me, your wife. And it's time to go home. Come, Heathcliff. Fill my arms with Heather.
Oh, Mishna.
Oh, Mark. Dude, you got any pot?
Oh, my God. I wish you were this frightened of losing your job all year. Wow.
So you wrote this, huh?
Sam Waterston.
That was great. So wait, you want to talk about bikes now, Jim? Are you doing all right? Because he had quite a pretty heated argument yesterday that you believe that the city's police are targeting bike riders.
It's a red herring.
Yeah?
Dave Livingston knows what I'm talking about.
What? Yes, you're a bike guy, and you think, what's the problem? What is the problem?
They're targeting bikes, just like cops in most major cities around this country do. They target bike riders because they can't do enough for real crime, and it's a very visual thing, and it's easy. And it's a red herring. That's
right. Hey, you know why? Real criminals don't pay their fines.
The New York Post here says citizen complaints led to a police crackdown now underway on scufflaw bicyclists.
Scufflaw! Yeah.
Scufflaw! What does that mean?
People that don't pay.
An NYPD spokesman acknowledged yesterday, we have gotten complaints from pedestrians, motorists, and business people of the hazard, and we're taking action to alleviate it. So you're right. They are cracking down.
They're cracking down, right. And, you know,
and legitimately, too.
Legitimately. You
crazed bikers.
Problem with you fat ass lazy New Yorkers is you you can't get out of your SUVs long enough to take a breath of fresh air and figure out what it's really like to get
70% of New Yorkers ride the train, you know?
Well, wait a minute, I have to tell you, I live in this city, I'm a proponent of bicycling, I own a bicycle that I used twice last year, and I get out sometimes.
It's very dangerous.
It's dangerous, but you know what, some of those bike riders are nuts. Have you seen these delivery guys? They're riding up the side of buildings.
I agree with
they're
you.
Jumping curbs.
I almost got hit by a delivery guy, too.
Yeah?
Yeah, he cursed at me and stuff.
Really? Wow, that's a hell of a story, Dave.
Yeah, shut up.
Cursed at Dave.
He cursed at Dave.
He used bad language.
And lived to talk about it.
Okay, we're going to finish this. 866-303-2270. Where do you stand on the bike argument in whatever city you come from? Because I got some evidence here, Mr. Safe Bike Rider, that says that sometimes even safe bike riding leads to horrible accidents, Jim.
That's right.
Manipulated evidence.
57 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
That's right. It's 6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. Hey, folks, tomorrow I'm going up to Burlington, Vermont. I thought I'd let you know. I'm going to do the show from up there on Friday. I'll be going up there after the show because Saturday night I'm going to be at the Higher Ground Comedy Club in Burlington this Saturday, November 19th, for two shows. It's presented by our affiliate up there, WVAA 1390 AM. You can go to highergroundsmusic.com, highergroundmusic.com for tickets. You can always email us here at sedition@airamericaradio.com. We're about to get into a conversation. We've got Jim Earl, a very angry Jim Earl, saying that he is being victimized. There is a conspiracy against all bikers, and this conspiracy is being played out by taxi drivers, commuters, people in crosswalks, the state, the country, the federal government, the executive branch, the judicial branch. Everybody is coming down on little Jim on his bike.
Well, not really. But, you know, I like the way you phrase it.
And then there's people who, you know, like myself, I believe in bikers' rights. I believe bike is a great way to go. I have a bike. I don't use it much. But I'll tell you, some bikers are a little crazy.
Of course they are.
There's a little concerns on both sides. And we got calls lined up. But
that's
before
right.
we get to them, I just want to do this. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So, Echo, we have the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. All right, here we go. Oh, I'm going to miss that. From Washington Post, Bush will be on friendly terrain in Japan. Bush will be on friendly terrain in Japan. Translation, Japanese assume all Americans are idiots. From San Jose Mercury News, Los Angeles is once again nation's smog capital. Los Angeles is once again nation's smog capital. Translation, Houston coughs up the smog title. Houston coughs up the smog title. How about L.A.'s future looks hazy? How about this? L.A. cough fidential. Nothing? Hey, Hollywood players blow too much smoke up each other's asses. How about that? All right, here we go. Oh, back to the iNews. From CBS News, researchers, hops in beer may be healthy. Hops in beer may be healthy. Translation, no, officer, I haven't been drinking. I've been training.
You know what's great about that story? Wayne Gilman said that months ago, and we made fun of him for it.
But yeah.
He said beer is... Well, he said...
It was very specific how he said it was healthy.
He said,
funny.
Beer is good for you. It's great for the testes.
Yeah. So that, how's that not going to be funny in any language? All right, so let's...
By the way, you're up in Vermont. I'll be at the Burlington Coat Factory.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, you're at the...
Mr. AutoZone.
You're going to be
names you want to drop? Any other corporate...
Go nuts in Vermont.
So you're going to be down here at the Burlington Coat Factory?
Yeah,
right down the block.
You're going to be looking for some cheap blankets and stuff to take on your trip across country?
I don't need it. I think I'll
on
only...
On your bike when you're going to be camping out?
I'm only going to make it the White Plains.
Oh, God.
And I'll be on the street.
Well, dig this, Jim. A Toronto study looked at 2,572 car and bike collisions. Car-bike collisions that occurred over a two-year period of time, 1997 to 98. 10 cyclists killed and 85 who suffered major injuries as a result of collisions with automobiles. Types of collisions. The most common, drive out at a controlled intersection. That means that if you think you're on the sidewalk doing the right thing and you just plow into the intersection and you got that blind spot because you think you've got it because you see people walking, bang, there goes your leg. Here's the other one. Cyclists being overtaken by cars from behind. Now, that's the one you're most concerned with, isn't it?
Yeah. There's one of them, and the other one is people deliberately targeting bikes. I was in a cab last month, and the guy just honked up, came up from behind and tried to run a guy out of the bike lane.
But this
happens all the time.
People
do not recognize people on bikes, and they're cutting down on smog and congestion, and they resent them for it for some reason. I don't know why.
But wait. The bike riding on the sidewalk thing, all right? And the bike riding on a sidewalk immediately prior to collision is the most commonly cited contributing factor. Now, bike riding on a sidewalk...
Toronto.
Here, too. Have you been here? Have you ordered Chinese food?
Here, too. Chinese food.
Here as well, these delivery guys are all over the place.
Of course
they are. Shouldn't be on the sidewalk.
Okay, well, you know what? Make it safer for them on the streets.
Okay, right, let's take
some
calls.
Bigger and better bike lanes.
Okay, bigger and better bike lanes in Manhattan?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Shut down 5th and 6th Avenue to everything except bike and pedestrian traffic. Shut down Times Square. Make it a walking square.
Why didn't you run for mayor?
How will trucks deliver anything to any business in that general area?
The way they always have, you know?
No, they
through the mafia?
Through the mafia. And where are they going to park if that becomes a gigantic pedestrian bike mall?
You know,
bike boy.
Amsterdam is the most congested city.
And Amsterdam Avenue is the most congested street in Manhattan. So what?
Congested city in Europe, practically. And
practically?
Even compared to New York. And it is a bike city. Bike
so they're
and pedestrian
all bike
city.
So what?
All right, here we go. Let's take some calls because this is going to get ugly and racial. I've seen it before.
Yeah.
Nick in Chicago, what's up? Yeah, now, they're cracking down in Chicago, aren't they, Nick?
Some. They've been issuing tickets, especially to people riding on the sidewalk.
That's what they're doing here, yeah.
Yeah.
I think bikes should be in the street. Here the law is you got to be 12 years old to ride on the sidewalk or younger. So
that kind of sort of makes sense.
What they need is more bike lanes, and they need to enforce people double parking in bike lanes.
Yeah,
and get them out of the bike lanes. And there needs to be more bike exclusive routes.
All right. Well, that seems reasonable. And now, can you ride if you're on a tricycle? Can you be over 12 on the sidewalk?
Unless you're a Shriner or something.
About officer discretion at that point, but
okay.
I was going to say, I think New York City, your problems there started at the Republican convention in 2004 with the critical mass ride, and they've been cracking down on the once a month bike parade, the critical mass. It's the last Friday of every month.
No, you're right, Nick, and there seems to be a personal animus between the NYPD, the police department here, and the organization Critical Mass.
Critical Mass is not officially an organization. It's just a group of people going on a bike ride. It's not, there's no official organization.
But they do, they can and they do tie up traffic intentionally, even though, the statement is it is what it is. But whether or not they are actually causing obstruction and causing difficulty, I mean, that's part of the price to pay for civil disobedience.
But wait a minute, if they're not an organization, how did they get the name Critical Mass?
It came from China, actually, where bicyclists there traditionally had to clump up together, get a large group of them, and then they finally move into traffic because they're such a large group, no car's going to hit them or try to get past them, because, and it's the safety in numbers.
Well, thanks for your call, Nick. That's very informative. So, well, this is interesting, because, you know, Brendan had an issue too with this. The day that Critical Mass did their protest, you know, he couldn't go to a Broadway show.
I'm sorry you missed Stomp.
but Jim,
don't knock percussionists, pal.
That guy, the point that he just made was that the police are deliberately targeting bicyclists out of vengeance because of the Critical Mass protesters. Mm-hmm. So those guys are making, you're saying it's civil disobedience. Yeah. They're making it worse.
No,
and
they're
they
not.
Have nobody on their side.
They're not making it.
They have nobody on
their side
but you, Jim.
Critical Mass. But me? You call yourself a newsman, you limo liberal.
I don't think a limo. I take a town car.
All right, let's take another call. Christine in Queens, that's my borough. What's going on?
Hey, Christine.
Hi, how are you guys? I love the show, and I'm going to miss you terribly.
Oh, thanks.
I'm a court clerk in the court in Queens, where bicyclists with the tickets come to plead not guilty and have their trials.
Uh-oh.
Do they bring their bikes into the courtroom?
No, they don't.
Oh.
I'm afraid not. It's a very little room. It only seats about 15 people.
So do they usually get off?
No, they usually get off. They usually get a small fine.
Okay, and does this work at all? Is it justified?
Well, it depends. I mean, I was knocked down by a bicyclist on the sidewalk, and one of the judges I work for was as well.
Wow, a judge too? You don't think think it was on purpose? Did you get a look at the guy?
Did you
see him in the courtroom?
No, we didn't see him in the courtroom.
All right. Well, thanks.
I was getting off a bus, and that's when I got hit.
Bang. See, that's it. That's dangerous.
No, that can
course.
Be a
thanks,
problem.
Christine.
You know, there are morons who drive everything.
But that's the thing,
you know,
Jim.
That's
there's
the
morons
point.
On bikes. There's morons
yes,
on cars.
Yes.
And they all kill each other.
Yes,
and so it
Brendan.
Evens out.
But you know what? It doesn't even out. Because right now, in the next, the last Friday of every month, they're going to have another critical mass, and you're going to have a helicopter, a police helicopter, and a bunch of wagons lined up, ready to have the cops waste resources and their time and money loading up the trucks with bikes and arresting bikers just because they're gathering.
If bikes could fly, that would be an amazing thing to watch. Like, you know, if they could just lift off the ground and fly around with the helicopters.
Have you gotten busted like that, Jim?
What are you, two?
Have you been?
What are you, living in, you know, like a Spielberg world or something?
Have you been arrested in a critical mass action?
No, I haven't. But, you know,
plan on doing it soon?
I've seen the cops do it down the Lower East Side, snickering, and they're, hey, we got our big helicopter with the floodlights. You know, this is great. You know, meanwhile, somebody raped in Queens. So,
all right, one more call.
Spend the resources on something better.
Hey, grown-up guy.
Yeah.
Why don't you put a lid on it for a second? All right, Kelly in Austin, how are you?
Hey, Kelly.
Hi.
Hi, what's going on?
Well, I actually used to live in Lower West Side Manhattan on 102nd Street between Amsterdam and Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of bikes in the area. But I moved to Austin, and I had never had the problems in New York with bikers that I've had in Austin, which it's, you know, kind of the leisure biking capital of the United States because of the whole Lance Armstrong thing. And they're like motorcycle gangs. Like, you have, like, you know, 30 or 40 grown men in, like,
you see, Jim?
What?
You give them too much freedom, they take the run of the place.
No, I think she's making the point that Austin is a paradise and a utopia.
Is that the point you're making, Kelly?
For what, speedos?
Wait, Kelly, what's the point?
It's not, because the bike lanes are not sort of, they're not a contiguous system, like they stop and start.
Well, they should be.
The only place in Austin worth riding your bike is downtown, because there are contiguous bike lanes, and that's, like, really the way Austin is built. You have, like, a little bit of, you know, suburban, you know, residential neighborhood, and then some, you know, city, and it's, like, all, like, patchwork crazy quilt. So it doesn't make sense to really try to ride your bike in Austin, and yet we have hordes of them.
Hordes. Bike riding hordes.
Hordes.
That sounds
like Amsterdam.
Is this a good or bad thing for you, though?
You'll have them. It's a terrible thing for me. I mean,
hordes, Jim. Hordes
to have
of
bicyclists
bikers.
is a bad thing. Maybe if we accommodated them more, you'd have less congestion on the road, and you would have less pollution.
But the thing is, when they try to, when they are in the bike lanes, you know, there are two of them sticking out of the bike lane.
That's terrible.
They kind of ease into the traffic and...
That's terrible.
That?
Is it to get in the way of your Humvee? What's going on there, down there?
And actually, I drive, you know...
She drives a Prius, pal.
What do you drive, Kelly?
I drive a Prius, but the thing is... the thing is that they do congest traffic, and they ignore all, like, the... Like the crosswalks down for the school zones.
Well, thanks for your call. Thank you for your call. Thanks a lot.
You know what congests
She's
traffic?
She's responsible.
You know what congests traffic more than anything else? Cars. not bicyclists. It's cars that congest traffic.
Oh, Jim.
You got one schmuck in their Humvee or their Ford Escort and they're causing
pollution.
Ford Escort? Ford Escort.
Is it still a subcompact?
I have a question. I was taught when I was a kid that you have to walk the bike across the street. Is that still a rule?
I have no idea.
You don't walk your bike across the street at
he
the crosswalk?
He doesn't have a bell on his bike either. And that's dangerous.
I have those tassels that hang off of my Stingray. I have the banana handlebars. Jim, do you have banana handlebars?
No, but I have a couple of cards in my spokes. You want to share some gum?
I've got just cards from the Wacky Pack puzzle that I already had. So, look, it's 19 past the hour. This has been very exciting. I'm glad someone from Austin called so people across the country couldn't go, it's still New York, that show. It's all in New York. No, bikers and bike problems are issues across this country. Right, Jim?
Damn straight.
You're going to take the message on the road when?
To Burlington. Burlington Coat Factory. I'll be there all weekend.
All right. 19 past the hour, morning sedition. We're going to have Christina Borgeson. Her book is Feet to the Fire, the Media After 9/11. Top Journalists Speak Out. Joins us live in the studio. Stay around. And Slenderman, right? Slenderman?
Yep. Yeah.
19 past. Again, morning sedition.
Hey, this is Rob Zombie, and it says here, when I'm watching the sunrise after a long night of waking the dead and toasting nachos in the microwave, I listen to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron, Mark Riley.
Yep.
As we know, the avian flu has popped up in Asia as well as England. One hopeful note, in England, the flu didn't infect other species at the same quarantine center, so it may not be ready to jump to humans. It's a good story, but we thought we could spice it up, maybe tweak it a little, on today's Morning Sedition Slander Minute. Here's our slander correspondent, Ted Fields. Ted, what can you add to this story?
Mark, I have it on secret authority that the avian flu not only is ready to jump to humans, but has jumped several people in the New York waterfront area and stolen their wallets and handbags.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
There was also some sexual assault, Mark. People should panic about this.
Whatever.
Mark, are you even listening?
Yeah, sure. He said the avian flu has been robbing people at gunpoint. Maybe it's also been soaping car windows and selling meth.
I was thinking of saying that, yeah.
Well, you didn't say it. I said it. You know, since your stories are always BS, pretty much, you know, anybody can do your job. You know what I'm saying?
Mark, my slander is developed through an excruciating process of professional journalism. No, not just anybody
Say, isn't the avian flu dating Diana Ross now?
Yeah, and I heard it was trying to reconcile with its estranged daughter, Angelina Jolie.
Yeah. See, come on, Ted. If you're going to make stuff up, maybe you can, you know, take a little competition.
I'll have you know, I have it on inside authority that the avian flu had the same pre-war intelligence is George Bush, and therefore is as much to blame for the war as he is.
Sources tell me that torture victims at CIA prisons said the avian flu was the number two man at Al-Qaeda.
Wow, sounds like we can win this war if we just can catch the avian flu.
I heard the avian flu's version of The Apprentice has been canceled.
Yeah, I heard the avian flu is launching its own line of children's books.
This is my slander minute, Mark.
All right, why don't you calm down?
You can't just barge in and do a slander minder's job for him. We're unionized now.
There's a slander union?
We're connected to the miners' union for some technical reason.
So you're threatening a strike?
Damn right. If I walk, so do the slanderers at Fox News and the Drudge Report. So you're going to let me do my segment?
I heard the avian flu is downplaying its 1985 statement on abortion.
That's it. I'm walking.
And that's today's Slander Minute on Morning's Edition with slander correspondent Ted Fields.
There are a lot of people who aren't going to come to work and make stuff up anymore.
I'm not going to be one of them. Oh, oh, man. Ted, you all right?
Yeah, I'm great, Mark.
Yeah. All right, so you got some work to do, right? You're going to go organize the rest of the other people or whatever you're going to do?
Yes, I am.
All right, see you later, Ben.
That's right.
All right, Ted, take care. We'll see you next week. Momentarily, Christina Borgeson, editor of Feet to the Fire, the media after 9/11, top journalists speak out, is going to join us live here in the studio. The last time she was on, people got very, very excited. She's very committed to what she's doing. I'll be at Higher Ground Comedy Club in Burlington, Vermont. That's Saturday night, November 19th, for two shows presented by WVAA. 1390 AM. Go to higherground.music.com for tickets. So in just a couple minutes, we are going to talk about the press and how angry they are. 27 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Our next guest walked into the studio, looked at me with this horrendous look of disappointment at my facial hair. The other day, Donald Rumsfeld joined in Bush's counteroffensive on pre-war intelligence. He went so far as to say that maybe it would be useful to retrace, as he put it, the actual history of U.S. involvement in Iraq. If you want to do that, I suggest you check out our next guest's book, Feel the Fire, The Media After 9/11, which released last week. Christina Borgeson joins us on the show this morning. Christina, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Oh, good morning.
Nice to be here.
I will shave. I will shave for you.
Oh, please.
No, I'm gonna. Okay.
You were so much cuter with that.
Oh boy. So this is a book filled with fire and excitement in terms of it is an outpouring from the press themselves. Why do you think this book is important right now?
Well, I think it's important because Bush just lashed out at his critics,
mm-hmm.
About his decisions for going to war, and the and of course a lot of people have criticized the mainstream media for not covering a lot of for not really scrutinizing his decisions for going to war. And in this book, the journalists who really did do their jobs.
Sure, you got some guys you've had on the show. Paul Krugman is in here. You got Helen Thomas, Ron Suskind. These are good guys, and there's a lot of people. Walter Pincus is in here. So these are people that did have the courage to stand up.
Yeah, but different things happen to different people. Mm-hmm. Like Walter's reporting, questioning what was being put out, often ended up on the back pages of the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
The Knight Ridder guys, who actually wrote in February 2002 an article saying, Bush wants to invade Iraq, didn't get any traction.
And these are the guys, Jonathan Landy, Warren Strobel.
Jonathan Landy, Warren Strobel. This book is worth getting just to read the Knight Ridder section because these guys did such amazing work. And there's a section in the book called National Security and mm-hmm. Intelligence, and it's all the masters of national security and intelligence reporting. I don't know if you guys know who Jim Bamford is, who mm-hmm. wrote Pretext for War.
I haven't read that book, and I'm surprised because these books are at least seen it. I don't know the book.
Well, Jim Bamford to me is the master because he's independent.
Okay.
And he was the one who wrote Puzzle Palace, mm-hmm. On the National Security Agency. Anyway, these guys give you chapter and verse of who was lying when. Okay. And you have to go back and remember because it's hard. The record needs to be put in one place, and
true.
That's what happened here.
The truth.
And, yes. Yes. And the thing is that people forget. I mean, there was an actual, almost like a corporate communications campaign with all these offices that were set up. And I don't know if you guys remember those offices, right? There was the Policy Counterterrorism Evaluation Group.
Right.
Okay. They were supposed to produce the evidence for the pretext for war. That's according to Bamford. And that was run by Cheney's Middle East advisor. David Wormser,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Landy from Knight Ridder, he also said that the group's job was to look for links between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. And eventually, the Policy Counterterrorism Evaluation Group came out with a memo detailing cooperation between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden.
Well, this is exactly relative to the leak case.
Exactly.
And this is at the core of
You've got to look at, first of all, okay, they came out with the memo, sent it out to all the conservative press, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Defense and the CIA both said this isn't true.
Right.
Okay? And then you have the Office of Strategic Influence that they tried to set up, and the public was like, forget it, that's too Orwellian. Then they have the Office of Special Plans. Okay, that's Advanced War Planning and Media Strategy, right? And that was created by Doug Feith. Remember, he slunk away.
And then the White House Iraq Group, too, right?
But that's the White House Iraq Group. They come next down the line, because the Office of Special Plans, they're the ones who are taking the intelligence and putting it into to a message for the White House Iraq Group to go out and send out.
Twisting it into the evil balloons.
Yeah, and you have... and this woman, Lieutenant Karen Kwiatkowski, I don't know if you've heard of her, but she was there in the Pentagon at the time that the Office of Special Plans was set up, and they were off in a corner. Nobody could talk about them. And she said, we were instructed at staff meetings that this office was not to be discussed or explained, and if people in the joint staff, among others, asked, we were to offer no comment.
And this is just the intelligence and national security section of this book.
It's unbelievable. And you have to understand, too, that the Office of Special Plans had a mirror office in Israel that was communicating through Doug Feith. And then, of course, the White House Iraq Group. Yes, and all these boys, you know, are these gentlemen, are reporting.
No, you got it right, boys.
No, she's talking about the reporters now, right?
Yes. I mean, first of all, what comes clear when, given what all these guys say, is that Cheney was really the main mover and shaker on this entire effort. And if you read, and by the way, when he lashes out at his critics, Bush talks about how, well, the Democrats looked at the same intelligence we did. And indeed, there are a couple things. A, the Democrats didn't see all of the intelligence, but I do think there was a failure of nerve on the part of a lot of Democrats.
No.
Because
Who, them?
Come on.
Well,
Christina,
I'm aware that I'm at Air America Radio, so, you know, I say this gingerly.
Well, we say that a lot, too.
Okay, good. Okay. Oh, good. So we're, like, really into the truth. Right. Okay, good. So, you know, the fact is that he talks about the National Intelligence Estimate. And if you looked at the public version of the National Intelligence Estimate, and the classified version of the net, it's like two different documents.
They did spin it. Now, this is something that's interesting, because I think the book speaks to the notion that a lot of these reporters who got this information didn't get it by talking to people at the top, but they got it by talking to people in the middle, people who were actually writing these documents.
Exactly. No? You see, while Judy Miller was talking to Ahmed Chalabi and Scooter Libby.
Guys on the payroll. Right.
Well, guys who are part of the whole effort. And,
right.
And really, somebody really needs to take a look at the different laws that are applicable to what happened here.
Well,
I mean, even RICO laws, you know?
Oh, right.
I mean,
racketeering.
It's just unbelievable. And I just want to talk about this NIE report for a minute, because everybody makes mention of it.
Let me tell everyone who you are first. Christina Borgensen is our guest. Her book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, is an edited anthology of journalists' work that covers a lot of different stuff. Go for it, Christina.
Well,
what
it looks at the pre-war and war reporting.
Okay.
Okay, and it starts with the pre-war and then goes to these major war correspondents. But let's get back to the NIE, because this lashing out is really, I mean, it's this whole campaign to lash out at the Democrats and so on for, you know, criticizing is such hubris when you look at the record. Mm-hmm. And the NIE is an important part of the record. And it's interesting to note that this NIE, first of all, he didn't want to come up with it. The administration, you know, dragged their feet forever and told Bob Graham, said, we've got to have this. We can't make a decision without it.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of 6 months, which is the usual time, they did it in 3 weeks. And I just want to give you a little example of the difference between
the
public version.
This is a national intelligence estimate.
Right, because that's what they use. You know, all the intelligence groups are polled, and, well, you know, their research is looked at, and then you come up with this national intelligence estimate.
Okay.
So let me just give you an example. Knight Ridder did the report that did the comparison. Public version says, most analysts assess Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons, and if left unchecked, will probably have a nuclear weapon this decade. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, actually, that's the public version, and it doesn't mention that the State Department's intelligence arm, the Bureau of Intelligence and research disagreed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's really key because that's the State Department's intelligence arm. The classified version says, the activities we have detected do not, however, add up to a compelling case that Iraq is currently pursuing what INR, meaning the State Department's intelligence arm, pursuing what INR would consider to be an integrated and comprehensive approach to acquire nuclear weapons.
So they didn't have them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the public version says Iraq's unmanned vehicles could be used for delivery of chemical and biological warfare, or chemical biological agents to Iraq's neighbors, U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Classified version says it showed major disagreement from the agency with the greatest expertise on such aircraft, which is the Air Force. The Air Force disagreed completely and says they don't agree that Iraq is developing UAVs primarily intended to be delivery platforms for chemical and biological warfare.
Right.
It goes on and on.
I got a question. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I see, because what's important here, I think, is the question of whether or not had the redacted part of this stuff been made public, whether or not there would have been any rationale for going to war based on weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I'll tell you. Go ahead, Christina.
Well, I don't know, other than whatever Bush may have found under his desk when he was looking
in that joke video.
Yes.
I think the interesting issue here is we certainly talk about this every day, and you're living it, Christina, by dealing with these journalists and putting their stuff out in an anthology that people can understand. But the truth of the matter is, most people, unfortunately, even if the truth was out there, might have missed it because of how little they pay attention. I think that a book like this is very important because you're investigating the nuances of just how much effort goes into obfuscating the truth and to manipulating lies in order to sell the ideology that they've been trying to sell.
Well, to me, the scariest part about it is how well organized it was. And, of course, it really made great use of television. I mean, television, I think, to say that television fell down on the job is really to put it way, way, way too mildly.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you see the reporting that these print reporters were doing, and you wonder if that had been on television, to my mind, if Landay and Strobel and Walcott of Knight Ridder had been on television pre-war,
as the lead story at 6 o'clock news,
you know, starting with their February 2002 report saying, you know what, Bush wants to invade Iraq, I don't know if things would turn out differently, but it would have raised humongous red flags.
And I'll tell you, because a lot of this stuff is buried either in the back of the paper or on websites or where places that aren't
common.
It's very easy for people that are already brainwashed to say, well, that's just BS. That's not real. That's a fringe thing.
Well, it is.
I mean,
if they're actually thinking about it at all. But I think the most terrifying part is when Walter Pincus describes...
No, go ahead.
You guys are making funny hand signals to each other.
We're just looking at the time.
Okay.
I think we got to finish up here. Christina Bordenson has been our guest. This book, I think, is a must read for people who want to know the truth and want to read some of the work of journalists that have been doing the real work of journalism out there in a lot of different areas. You know, we're talking about security and intelligence. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about people who are actually in the war. It's feet to the fire. The media after 9/11. Christina, it's great talking to you.
Great to be here.
We'll be back in a few. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, fasten your seatbelts and prepare yourselves to be rocked, rocked, rocked. Now entering the studio is the man who joins us each and every Wednesday. He's president of the New Democracy Project and the co-author of the book on Bush. Make some noise for the monster of Midtown, the Goliath of Gotham, Mark Guerin.
We'll be right back. We're branding you, Mark. You got a weekly spot. We want to make sure people remember it and they lock in.
Yeah, but I thought I was David, not Goliath. To change my image. You know?
Maybe that's a good thing.
I'll try Goliath next time.
So I see you're reading. You're picking up the copy of Christina Borges' book.
What a great guest.
Yeah. Now she brought up a lot of stuff around how the media, how some journalists have been cowed by the Republican administration, by the neocon death cult, the cabal that has taken over this country, and you agree with that?
Totally. Half the Democrats voted against the resolution to go ahead in Iraq. The other half either were misled or did lose their nerve. I agree with her point. It was just before the 2002 elections. You had a warrior president after 9/11, and they swallowed and flinched. And now Bush's last-ditch argument, now that his poll numbers have collapsed from 51 in his vote to 36% favorable in Newsweek, is, well, they went along with me, and now they're flipping.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And if this doesn't work, and it shouldn't on the merits, according to Christina and all the evidence, he's sunk. This is his final ninth inning at bat.
It doesn't seem like it can work to me. What he's pitching, there's too much contrary evidence, and it seems like most of the country no longer believes him.
Well, in 2002, Eric Alterman, who's been on this station a lot, and sure. I think up a book. Bush routinely misleads people. He's a serial misleader. And at the time, he was a popular president, and it seemed a little, shall we say, Air America-ish, even before you started. Well, now, everybody either agrees with it. Bush is down to sort of one-third of the country. Remember, 42% of the country believes in demonic possession.
Yeah.
He is below demonic possession.
Yeah.
And I don't see how he much pulls himself out of it, because the evidence is contrary. One last thing on Christina's book. It reminds me, 15, 20 years ago, Mark Hurstgard wrote a book called On Bended Knee about Reagan and how the press kissed his hem there for reasons of personality and charm. Now, because people defer to a president who keeps saying he's a war president. And 20 years apart, the press was complicit both times in not blowing the whistle on what was in front of them.
But let's talk for a moment, Mark, if we can, about whether or not there are some Democrats who are complicit at the same time. We saw and have seen over the long term a number of Democrats in the Senate particularly jump ship, the latest being five Democrats who voted along with the majority to kill that whole issue of the terrorism situation and the detainees. How do you deal with these Democrats who are, many of whom are in red states, and who feel that if they don't go along at least in some measure with the president, they're going to lose their jobs?
I don't know the answer, because for a couple of hundred years, people who hold office and are incumbents like getting reelected. And if Ben Nelson is to the left of his constituency in a red state, it's pretty hard for Harry Reid or the three of us to lecture him on what's in his interest and the national interest. The fact, though, Mark, is I have never seen such relative unanimity among Democrats, for the obvious reason they're the minority party. Mm-hmm. Either they hang together or hang separately, to pick up Ben Franklin's original comment. So while you're right, they broke off on the detainee torture issue.
And the Iraq timetable issue. That was the other thing I was thinking of.
But look at the trend line. Yesterday, for the first time since this war began, since pre-war, a majority of Republicans hinted, it's easy to read between the lines, we got to get out. Dr. Bill Frist, we're not talking about just Russ Feingold, Dr. Bill Frist said, we got to, at some point, we have to start the evolution toward leaving. And the Bush administration has now lost control, in effect, of the Republican Senate on the war.
But that's not really any sort of proposal, it's just a political move.
Fine, but the Nick Kristof thesis, which is, okay, Cindy Sheen, you don't pull out today.
Yeah.
George Bush, you don't stay 20 years and spend another $300 billion.
So you say somewhere in between.
There is now an emerging consensus, which is, it's not cutting and running. When you spend $300 billion, you lose 2,000 men and women. Probably 30,000 are coming home limbless, guys, because the Bush people are willfully miscounting the injured, because they're not counting, as in prior wars, those who were injured by accident en route to and from a battle. And so they're shorting the numbers so it looks even better.
So before we go, we got about 15 seconds. What do you think of Hillary's trip to Israel?
Even if she weren't thinking about running for president, she's a New York United States senator. Of course she's going to go to Israel, but she's going through her paces. I remember quickly marching with Hillary in the Israeli Day Parade the year she ran for Senate, and being epithets were being thrown at her. She smiled right through it because she had a photo with Mrs. Arafat, and it was politically damaging. She is now lionized by pro-Israeli folks in the city and the state and the Jewish community. And so the arguments against her in the past are being slowly whited out.
Uh-huh.
And it's harder to be in a stronger position should she choose to run in 08. And this is part of the effort.
Thank you, Mark Green. Good to see you. See you next Wednesday. Here's your phrase of the day, folks. Just drop it in the conversation. Insight Magazine says the only people George Bush will talk to are his wife, his mother, Condoleezza Rice, and Karen Hughes. The good news for progressives is that the women are running the country. The bad news is they're all whacked out. Wake up, sheeple. The best man for the job is a woman. That George Bush...
Larry King here.